we started to get these larger data sets on people, we said, okay, well, we got to look at their inflammation. We got to look at their insulin resistance. We got to look at the pathogens and the toxins and the vasculature and all. We started realizing, we're seeing profiles where the main problem is.
Wouldn't you like to know? Well, you're going to find out today in this episode. Hey guys, and welcome. You're listening to The Reslier Way with Jacob Gordon. I'm your host, Jacob, and I'm so excited to have you here today. On today's episode, I have Dr. Dale Bredesen. He's an internationally recognized expert in the mechanisms of neurodegenerative diseases, such as Alzheimer's. He's held faculty positions at UCSF, UCLA, UCSD, and directed the program of anti-aging in the Burnham Institute before starting the Buck Institute. He's currently renowned for his latest books on reversing Alzheimer's disease and preventing neurocognitive decline. I've personally incorporated some of his RECODE protocol into my daily life and wrote about it, as well as all the mechanisms, on my website, mybiohack.com. So today, Dr. Craig Tanio, Dr. Dale Bredesen, and I will all be discussing multimodal approaches to neurocognitive decline, his latest research study on Alzheimer's disease, his upcoming books, mechanisms into Alzheimer's disease, ALS, Parkinson's disease, macular degeneration, and much more. I had a fantastic time interviewing Dr. Bredesen, and be sure to stick around till the very end. So without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Dale.
Hey, Dave.
Thanks for being here with Craig and I.
Excited to be here. Thanks very much.
We're very excited to have you here on the show today. I followed your research for quite some time now, and I know Craig has been practicing with you.
Yeah.
So we're both really happy to have you here on the show.
Great. Thanks. And this is an exciting time, I think, for all of us, watching things change for the way people are treated for multiple different chronic illnesses. This is just a very exciting time.
It is a very exciting time. Craig and I, for the sake of our patients, we would like to know a little bit more about you, who you are, and what kind of research you've done, a little bit about your story.
Yeah, sure. I was very interested actually in mathematics when I was a kid. And so I went to Caltech and actually worked at MIT also, and got interested in the brain. When I was a freshman, read a book called The Machinery of the Brain, and all about how the brain is similar to a computer. Got very interested, and then ultimately interested in why the brain goes wrong, why you get these various diseases. And of course, it turned out when I went to medical school and then neurology residency and then neurology fellowship to study neurogenetics and molecular neurobiology, it turned out, of course, that this is the area of greatest biomedical therapeutic failure. So, we can do a lot, even with men. There are many cancer survivors, but as they always say, there's no Alzheimer's survivor. And so whether it's Alzheimer's or ALS or frontotemporal dementia or Lewy body disease or PSP or CVD, just go right down the list of all these neurodegenerative diseases. And they have just been untreatable. And so it's really been, it's been unfortunately a death sentence. So I actually was a postdoctoral fellow in the laboratory of Stan Prusiner, who won the Nobel Prize for studying and discovering prions. And so I set up a lab, and we've been working for the last 30 years in the lab, looking at what actually drives neurodegeneration. So that's been the question. What are the molecular drivers of this process of neurodegeneration? Why is it so common? Alzheimer's is now the third leading cause of death, according to Professor Christine Yaffe from UC San Francisco, now the third leading cause of death in the United States. Just an incredibly common problem. And, just for perspective, the projection is that somewhere around 500,000 people in the United States will die of COVID-19. It may be more, but we're up to over 300,000 currently. For perspective, almost 100 times that many of the currently living Americans will die of Alzheimer's disease. So as large a pandemic as COVID-19 is, the Alzheimer's pandemic is actually much larger. And so we really need to work together, all of us, to develop ways to prevent and reverse this very common problem.
And Dale, when you, I'm just really curious in the research that you were doing, when did you first kind of come on the notion that a multimodal and a more holistic approach would be a better answer to Alzheimer's?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And just for clarification, let me say, because people often say, this is just about lifestyle or just about this or just about that. The whole point of this is very straightforward, that all the previous trials of Alzheimer's have been predetermining what you're going to treat it with. So you say, I'm going to treat it with this drug, or I'm going to treat it with, you know, this lifestyle change, whatever. All we're saying is, no, you have to flip the script the opposite. You have to say, what is causing this problem? So this is truly root cause medicine, as so much of functional medicine is. But people have not been doing this in Alzheimer's in the past. So we need to look at a whole set of variables. We look at 150 different variables currently, some historical, some biochemical, some genetic, of course, and looking to see this. So what happened was, we were looking at a very reductionist approach, and looking at what are the things that actually cause the death of the cells. And we were functioning, we were focusing on the function of amyloid precursor protein, because it is the parent. It gives rise to the amyloid that we all know is part of the brain in Alzheimer's disease. And what was really surprising is that when you look at this molecule, APP, it is cleaved in one of two alternative ways. So it almost functions like a molecular switch. And so when things are good, you've got enough nerve growth factor, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, hormones, nutrients, energy, you know, oxygenation, all of this, it is cut at a single site, which is called the alpha site. And therefore you get two pieces, one that goes outside the cell, one that goes inside the cell. And these things turn out to signal synaptoblastic activity. You're making and keeping synapses. So things are good. When things are bad, when you have a reduction in hormones and a reduction in nutrients, reduction in trophic factors, reduction in energy, or you have inflammation, ongoing pathogens or toxins, this same molecule is now cut at three different places. And so you get four pieces, which are called SAPP beta, A beta, the amyloid that we all associate with Alzheimer's, but it's a much bigger story than that, JCASP and C31. And those four actually tell the system you got to downsize. So what's interesting is it's actually a protective response. So this switch is going back and forth between two modes. One mode is things are good, we're going to grow. The other mode is things are bad, we're going to protect ourselves. So your brain is not trying to give you Alzheimer's. It's not, you know, people have said before, amyloid is bad. No, it's simply you've got insults ongoing. And so therefore, this molecule is now trying to help protect your brain. And so you've got to identify those insults. So we're actually sitting, we had developed a drug that we were going to have tested, and it did ultimately go into clinical trials, that will change this, will change the balance and flip it over from the good side to the bad side. But I was sitting at the board. This was about 2009, right in there. And I was sitting at the board saying, well, what if, you know, there are other problems? What if there's, you know, insulin resistance or what? So I thought, well, okay, let's add a little this. And then I thought, well, we should probably do some brain training. And I started putting this on a big whiteboard, actually. And after about the third one, I thought, well, why would we exclude anything? Like, I thought, like, duh, you know, that kind of duh moment. And I thought, oh my God, we're developing a drug, and the drug is not going to deal with all the reasons that you have this problem. So then we proposed in 2011 the first comprehensive trial, and it got shot down. They would not let us do it.
Well, it's interesting because it's like the question is, are you trying to develop a drug, or are you actually trying to change the disease? And you could see all of these factors and say, it sounds like it just kind of hit you one day that a more comprehensive approach was going to be the right way. And is that because this balance was just being affected by all of these other physiologic factors you could see?
Yeah, so when we realized that, okay, and there's all sorts of published literature on what changes APP from producing, you know, the two good guys, or what we used to think of as the four bad guys and the two good guys. We would try to get drugs that change that. And then I realized, like, wait a minute, there are all these other things that are going to affect this. So when we were trying to go through that, we realized, okay, this thing that we call Alzheimer's, we're getting a new view of it. We're realizing it's really at its most fundamental nature, it is an insufficiency. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. And, you know, again, it's like, well, isn't that obvious? It's an age-related problem that's associated with not enough support and too much demand, too much inflammation, too many pathogens, too many toxins. So it should have been obvious to me years ago, but it wasn't, that this is fundamentally an insufficiency. And so you have to identify, you know, both the supply and the demand. Mm-hmm. And so we realize that, you know, what this disease is all about is not meeting the demand with the supply. So we've got to reduce the demand by reducing the inflammation, reducing the toxicity. And we got to increase the supply by increasing the hormonal support, the NGF, the BDNF, the nutritional support, the, you know, all the energetic support. And this is really what this disease at its most fundamental nature is. Mm-hmm. So then we realize, okay, we got a new handle on what these, we think maybe the major neurodegenerative diseases are all mismatches with their, so there are different subsystems within the brain. Alzheimer's is all about neuroplasticity. Mm-hmm. That's why, of course, memory is affected so commonly. Whereas, for example, Parkinson's is more about energetics. It's about motor control. Mm-hmm. But it has its own subset of requirements. And as you know, mitochondrial complex 1 is a critical part of that. So is ubiquitination and proteasomal degradation of proteins. So each of these subsystems, and of course there's a third subsystem for macular degeneration, and a fourth one for progressive supranuclear palsy, and another one for Lewy body. So each of these has its own Achilles heel that we tend to kind of overstep during our lifetimes if we're going to get that illness. So therefore, we need to, for each of these, identify the numerous contributors, both on the supply and the demand side. And then we can target those with a prescriptive, personalized precision medicine program. That's the idea.
I mean, I remember reading your first book and thinking, this is really a different way to practice medicine. And if we're going to address chronic disease, we just have to really organize the system around such a different approach, because so much of healthcare is just kind of geared towards, you know, the single solution, you know, the silver bullet as and not the silver buckshot, as you say.
Yeah. It's a really good point. And let me just comment on that. So, you know, there, you're absolutely right. A lot of this has been, okay, the theory is now beginning to emerge. And the interesting thing, the theory tells you how to treat people. It tells you who's going to get better, who's not going to get better. But it's to make it practical, to make it feasible has been not easy. Just as you said, it's just very much like when people first brought computers to their homes years ago. It's like, okay, now wait, where do I print? And like, how do I communicate with other people? There, you know, it's going to get better and better over time. Same thing, by the way, with Zoom conferences and things like that. Sure. They were clunky 10 years ago or 5 years ago even. But people keep starting, you know, solving these. And we're at the same sort of situation where, what do you have to do to get a person better? And how do you get them into ketosis? And how do you change these biochemical parameters that are currently shutting their brains down? It took us a while to realize how critical nocturnal oxygenation is, how many of these people have reduced oxygenation. Because as you know, usually when you get evaluated at a typical center for Alzheimer's, they're not checking that. They're not checking your mycotoxin exposure. They're not checking your insulin resistance typically. They might check, an inflammatory parameter like hsCRP or something, but they're not checking 90% of what's actually driving the problem. Mm-hmm. And so we all need to start looking at these things. And again, people will say, well, you know, it's not reimbursed yet. Okay, but the problem is the average person spends about $350,000 over their lifetime with Alzheimer's. In other words, the nursing home costs, the medication costs, the doctor visit, it's horrible. Right. And so you can cut that dramatically by getting in early and treating people and getting good outcomes. And we've got people now who are over 8.5 years on the protocol and doing very, very well still. So once you improve, you know, you sustain your improvement. Now that doesn't mean everybody improves. We still need to understand why that is. But we see patterns. People who are very, very late, of course, are harder. People who are not doing the right things, of course, are not going to do as well. people who have severe toxicity. But we do have people who are doing well for many years.
So I guess take me back to 2011. You've got these ideas around how it can, how the practice could be revolutionized, and you're going to the IRB, the Institutional yeah. Research Board. What happens there?
Yeah, so we had both of for the original one, we actually were going to do with that drug I mentioned, it was, mm-hmm. it was called tropisetron, that we had discovered in the lab, makes this interesting change in APP. Interestingly, it turns out to have effects on the nicotinic cholinergic system, so it helps memory. It has effects on inflammation, so it turns out to be helpful once again. And interestingly, it also interacts directly with APP. So we were enthusiastic about this, and we thought, okay, we're going to have four arms. So we're going to do placebo and the drug, okay, as we always do. But then we also want to do a whole program with placebo and a whole program with the drug. Right. So I was excited about the idea that maybe, you know, the two are going to be synergistic. Well, actually, if you put the two together, we could get a big impact. So we actually had to do it in Australia because this drug was available there, not available in the U.S. And both the public and private IRBs said, no, you know, we're not going to allow you to do this because it's too many variables. And we said, well, hey, this is a multivariable disease. Mm-hmm. You know, how can you, and I think this is one of the problem with our trials. Everybody wants to change one variable,
right.
But that's not how the disease works for the vast, vast majority of people. And so, and I got a call actually from a philanthropist who had supported some of the work and said he was really angry and, you know, how come we didn't get this thing approved? And if I had been his employee, he would have fired me. And oh my gosh, it was horrible. And so I was really depressed. Like, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to get this through? And right shortly thereafter, I got a call from who turned out to be patient zero, who had been sent out by her friend from the East Coast. So I just told her, look, we just got turned down, and so I really can't do anything. I can tell you about our research. I can tell you, you know, what we were trying to do. And so we spent hours going through all these different things, and she took all these notes, and then she called me 3 months later and said, I can't believe how much better I am. I'm back at work full time. Everything's great. And she is now over 8.5 years. That was April of 2012. And so I was really excited when she called back after 3 months. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, this is telling us we're on the right track. And so we thought, okay, if we get enough anecdotal evidence, maybe we'll be allowed to do a trial.
Sure.
So over the last 8 years, we've collected anecdotal evidence. And as you know, because you helped us, thank you for that. We were turned down again in 2018 to do a comprehensive trial. And then finally in 2019, we got approved. Although interestingly, these IRBs are so far behind. Even though they approved us in 2019, they said for this first trial, you'll not be allowed to do a control group. Well, how silly is that? So we have to do as controls. It's going to be a historical control. Luckily, there's so much data, as you know, for the years and years. You know, when people have Alzheimer's, they're not going to improve on their own. They're going to go downhill.
Right.
And that's well documented, and we know about the rapidity, although it varies from person to person. So we've just completed the trial, and we're actually working on getting all the data together, but very, very exciting. And, you know, looking very much like what we've all seen with the anecdotes. So very excited, and it gives us a denominator, which is nice. And so things look very, very promising. And I think this is going to be the way to test even new drugs in Alzheimer's. I think of many of these drugs that have failed, and as you know, there are over 400 failed clinical trials with Alzheimer's. It's just been horrible. Testing these as part of an overall program actually makes much more sense.
So just tell us about the study right now. I know you can't give the exact results until it's published, but how many people ended up getting studied versus historical controls?
So this beginning is a small proof of concept trial. Just 25 people went through. Good news for the vast majority of them. So that was very exciting. And, you know, again, we'll have something published, I hope, in the next few months.
Oh, great. Well, we're really looking forward to hearing that. And I'm curious just the dialogue with the research community. I mean, what do you think it will take to kind of win people over you know, sometimes when you're changing paradigms, it can be a little bit of a lonely battle. You know, how do you see that dialogue evolving?
You know, it's a really good point. And I've really, I've been surprised. I went into academic neurology because I really thought this is where the truth is. This is where, you know, we're going to find new things. We're going to find, you know, new information. Mm-hmm. And it's going to, you know, we're going to ultimately have something that will help these various patients. And I've really been surprised to see how much pushback there is, how much just dogged determination that we're going to stick to a one drug approach. And this is the way it's always going to be. And we're not going to allow any other consideration. I've been very surprised at the closed-mindedness. And so fortunately, the whole, you know, functional medicine community and, you know, Jeffrey and you and, you know, David and Mark Hyman, all the various people who embrace functional medicine have really understood that the science, if you just go, we've been completely agnostic. I didn't have any particular interest in functional medicine. So we're just looking at what actually helps these people.
Sure.
And if you just go straight from the test tube to the bedside, what you end up with is a functional medicine approach. Mm-hmm. And so it really, you know, it makes a lot of sense. I do think that in the long run, it's going to take showing that, you know, in large trials, you can repeatedly make people better. And so there's, you know, you're kind of working at two things at once. On the one hand, you want to continue to make the protocol better and better and better.
Right.
So to some extent, I think that these, you know, anecdotes are actually teaching us all a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because you find out, oh, you know, we really do have to look more at nocturnal oxygenation or a specific level of ketosis or specific pathogens that are coming up again and again and again. Or, you know, oral microbiome. You know, there's things that are coming out that are turning out to be critical. Or, you know, specific toxins that you didn't realize before are major players in Alzheimer's disease. And at the same time, we've got to think about large trials. And, you know, all the trials are set up to evaluate single variables. And that's a real problem. The fundamental nature of the way clinical trials in medicine are set up is against a functional medicine sort of approach. So we really have to have more understanding of this form of medicine if we're going to get optimal outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we've been trying to work on, we actually got IRB approved the last couple of months, is to set up a registry.
Yes.
And to at least kind of, if you can't do it against the control, at least be prepared as a practice who's trying to follow a lot of these root causes principles to capture all the data. And one of my thoughts would be is if we could accelerate the number of people who are capturing all of the data, at least that can get us a sense of what the upside really is for patients, you know, because there's a big move in, you know, conventional medicine to just understand real world data, because we all know that the data doesn't always apply from research as it gets translated into clinical practice. But, you know, my hypothesis is when you do root cause medicine, it may actually be the opposite, that the real world data may look better than what actually is happening in these single intervention studies, because no one's looking at how they all add up together.
Absolutely. And, you know, you can see this even in the molecular biology of this. You can see that, you know, as an example, when you add estradiol, for example, estradiol binds to its receptor, you know, enters the nucleus, alters the transcription of hundreds of genes. And one of the genes that has an increase in its protein is the alpha secretase. So you now you're pushing that APP toward a synaptoblastic type of signal. Mm-hmm. And on the opposite side, you have inflammation, NF-kappa-B gets activated. Mm-hmm. It also affects hundreds of genes, and it affects the genes that are actually cutting to give you the four that are on the protective side, because you've got something invading. You've got an ongoing inflammatory state. And there are, you know, there are many parallels between what's happening with COVID-19 and what's happening with Alzheimer's disease, including this cytokine. Of course, it's cytokine storm in COVID-19, and in Alzheimer's, it's cytokine drizzle. You're drizzling these cytokines kinds, you know, for dozens of years that are ultimately giving you this pullback. So absolutely, I agree with you. I think a registry is a fantastic way to go. And, you know, as we start to get all these data, we're going to be able to see what's actually critical. And this is where artificial intelligence is going to be so helpful, because you're no longer looking at yes variable, no variable. Right. Now you're looking at hundreds of things that are changing. And so you need to see thousands of people to see, okay, what are the patterns here? You know, one of the things that's been interesting is people have assumed that this is a linear system. That is to say, if you're going to use 3 or 5 or 10 or 20 interventions, then you have to show that each one by itself has a statistically significant effect. Well, that's not the way biology works. So there are going to be many of these things that by themselves don't have a statistically significant effect. But when you put them together as a protocol that is targeting the problem of that particular person, it'll have a striking effect. So if you want to study how one thing works, you're going to have to probably take it away from an overall protocol, or you're going to have to use AI to study many, many different people and to see patterns that look critical. And I think we'll all begin to learn, you know, more and more about what are the most critical pieces of this.
Well, it definitely feels like clinically that people hit their tipping point where it becomes very clear that something positive is happening, but that tipping point isn't always the same from different individuals to different individuals. And so that's, I think, one of the big challenges.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is the same thing that Dean Ornish found with cardiovascular disease 30 years ago, that you have to get to a threshold. So again, in his case, you have atherogenic and atheroclastic effects. And so as he found, when you get to that tipping point, you actually start picking up the plaque again instead of instead of putting it down. And, you know, we're seeing, as you said, the same thing with cognition. You can essentially imagine theoretically that change in APP. You're going from predominantly synaptoclastic signaling, losing synapses, shutting down the brain, atrophy, Alzheimer's disease, to a predominantly synaptoblastic form of signaling, where people are now saying, wait a minute, I can remember things again, I can learn new things again. And it is striking to see these people as they come back and say, oh my gosh, you know, I've got my ability to form new memories back once again. And so what's interesting is there is clearly a chemical effect here. We know that Alzheimer's has chemical effects, but also has anatomical effects. So we really need to think in terms of removing the problems that are causing this, whether it's mycotoxins or the insulin resistance or the vascular supply, etc. Then a resilience, getting all the trophic factors lined up and getting all the different pieces, but then ultimately a rebuilding as well, because you've lost a number of synapses even relatively early in this disease. As you know, the diagnosis of Alzheimer's doesn't come typically until 20 years after the pathophysiology begins. So one of the things that we all have to do is encourage people to get in as early as possible, preferably on prevention when they turn 45. But if you don't do that, then at least get in as early as possible, because we really realize now that we can make Alzheimer's a rare disease. This should be a very rare problem.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point that so much of this can be prevented. And the downside of following some of these programs, as you have said before, is to lose weight and feel better.
Exactly.
But in your first book, you talk about the five or six different types of Alzheimer's, and just curious how you kind of settled on those and how that's kind of helped to implement the protocol.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So what happened, we were looking at, okay, what are the things that drive APP toward Alzheimer's type signaling, synaptoclastic signaling versus the other direction? And again, as I said, you could follow things like estradiol. You can follow the molecular species directly to changing APP. And so as we started to get these larger data sets on people, we said, okay, we got to look at their inflammation. We got to look at their insulin resistance. Got to look at the pathogens and the toxins and the vasculature. We started realizing, we're seeing profiles where the main problem is inflammatory. So we called that type 1 inflammatory. You know, again, it makes sense. So much of age-related problem so is so-called inflammaging. But again, it's not all of it. There are so many people that ever want to grab onto one thing. Okay, it's all about inflammation. Okay, it's all about A, B, or C. It's not. As you said earlier, you know, this is like an orchestra that's got to be playing together. It's like a whole group of things that has to be coordinated. So there are people that have mostly this inflammatory type 1. There are people that have mostly type 2. They're very different. They're atrophic. They're dried up. They don't have nutritional, hormonal, and trophic factor support. And getting that optimized is helpful to them. They're often the kind of, you know, the older people that in their 70s or 80s, and they have low levels of these various things that need to be replaced. So that's type 2 or atrophic Alzheimer's. And then interestingly, the glycotoxics, the people who have insulin resistance, we call them type 1.5 or glycotoxic because they have both. They have the inflammation of the glycation, the non-enzymatic glycation of the proteins. And of course, we measure this as hemoglobin A1C, but there are hundreds and hundreds of proteins that are glycated. It changes their shape. It changes their immunogenicity. So you have that inflammatory piece, but you also have the insulin resistance. So an insulin is such a critical factor. When we used to grow brain cells in dishes, you always had to include insulin, transferrin, and selenium. Those were the big three that make these neurons survive. And so insulin is a critical trophic factor. And when you lose your sensitivity to it, you really are putting yourself at risk. And as you know, this is so common in Alzheimer's. So that's type 1.5. And then type 3, we didn't know about at the beginning until we saw people who were failing when we would get the other three fixed. We thought, wait a minute, what's going on here? And these turned out to be very toxic people who have, as you know, toxins. And it's typically one of three groups. It's the metals or other inorganics. And of course, a lot written about air pollution lately. Really worrisome with the California fires, really worrisome with the air pollution in various cities. This clearly increases your risk for cognitive decline. Yep. Then there's the organics. All of the things like formaldehyde and glyphosate and benzene and toluene. People who are around the World Trade Center. People who have a candle burning for years, paraffin candles, and have high levels. People who are around car exhaust and things like that. Acrolein and stuff like that. All at increased risk for cognitive decline. And then the third group, of course, is the biotoxins, especially the mycotoxins, the trichothecines and the ochratoxins and all these sorts of things that are critical, that turn out to be so common in their contributions to cognitive decline. And again, it's as I wrote about a few years ago, this is a treatable yet unrecognized epidemic. There are just so many people who have this. So that's type 3, toxic. Then, of course, type 4 is energetic. It's vascular. These are people who have a vascular contribution. When I was a resident, we learned to perform what was called a Hutchinsky score that tells you whether you have vascular dementia or Alzheimer's. And, of course, that turned out to be wrong. There's a lot of vascular component to Alzheimer's. And so vascular support. And again, it boils down to an insufficiency. You need oxygen. You need the ketones to burn or something to burn. And you need the blood flow. And if you're missing any of those, and of course you need the mitochondria to do the burning, any of those four that are not working optimally, and you are at increased risk for cognitive decline. So you've got to look at that and optimize that. And many people, you know, their blood flow is just not what it should be. So that's type 4, which is vascular. And then, of course, type 5 is traumatic. So people who've had head trauma have increased risk for cognitive decline from Alzheimer's. Of course, also CTE, which is very common. But when you get head trauma, beautiful work years ago showing that when you have head trauma, what happens? You make a lot of amyloid for the next week or 10 days at least when you have had head trauma. So again, this is part of this protective response when you've lost those synapses. So those are the six types of Alzheimer's. And again, as you know, people often have multiple. They've got some vascular component, they've got some inflammatory component. But often what you'll find is that there will be a predominant one that people will have mostly metabolic syndrome, for example, and have, you know, kind of a combination of 1 and 1.5, or they'll have mostly a vascular presentation. And so many have a toxic presentation. And until you get that toxicity dealt with, you aren't going to get a lot of improvement. The good news is you can begin by treating some of these other pieces and then tweaking. And as you know, these people often look different. Your typical APOE4 associated inflammatory or glycotoxic Alzheimer's, these are people who typically show up in their 60s, for example, and they often have a kind of an American lifestyle. They've got a high hsCRP, they've got some glycotoxicity, they have a poor lipid profile. But then you've got the ones who are mycotoxic. They often show up in their early 50s, and they've got, you know, they have a non-amnestic presentation. They look different. People often think initially, oh, this isn't an Alzheimer's patient. It may be more like frontotemporal dementia. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they do have Alzheimer's, either by PET scan or by CSF. And it turns out that they have this mycotoxicity that you have to identify and detox. And they often, of course, do better if you optimize their hormones as well. So these groups tend to look different as well, and you can, of course, figure this out with the, you know, with their biochemical profiles, and then, of course, respond differently. They need, obviously, targeted to their problems to get best outcomes.
For someone with SIRS or other mold-related Alzheimer's, would that fall moreover into the biotoxin or the inflammatory type of Alzheimer's or the glycotoxic?
Yeah, you're right. So they really have type 3. It's mostly it's a toxin-related problem. And these other toxins, it's a really good point you make, because the other toxins don't tend to give you as much of an mm-hmm. inflammatory response, whereas someone with a biotoxin has that combination of some degree of inflammation. As you know, their hsCRPs typically are mm-hmm. not off the charts,
right,
but they might be 1.5 or 2. So absolutely, you're getting some inflammatory response. And interestingly, for these, just as with COVID-19 and patients with Alzheimer's, they tend to have this mismatch between their innate immune system. So you've got this inflammation ongoing, but their adaptive system is not keeping up. So the adaptive system should be coming on, clearing things, and then resetting the innate system. But that's not happening. So you have a chronic insufficiency of the adaptive system, whereas therefore you have this just continued. You know, the A-beta, the amyloid itself, is actually a part of the innate immune system's response. So again, your immune system thinks it's doing its job. Yes, you've got a problem. Mm-hmm. I'm helping you with that by turning this on. But now wait, what's happening to my adaptive system that should be coming in, cleaning things up, and then resetting me? So it's just in this long-term mode of saying, I'm waiting, I'm waiting, I'm waiting. And while I'm waiting, I'm making A-beta, I'm making cytokines. And so you're right, in for people who have this kind of the type 3, the biotoxin type, they have some degree of inflammation, as Richie Shoemaker and others have pointed out over the years, in addition to their significant toxicity. They're really, as you know, this is affecting all sorts of structures. There's, you know, nephrotoxicity, there's immunotoxicity, there's neurotoxicity. You can even have carcinogenicity from some of these things. So these, you know, these molds are fighting us to stay alive.
Yeah, it's like a battle. What I find really interesting about your work is showing how amyloid beta or beta amyloid is actually a protective mechanism and not what we're trying to treat.
We're trying to treat what's causing the beta amyloid. So yeah, great biomarker to tell you something bad is going on. But I think it's led to, unfortunately, the spending of billions of dollars to try to get rid. This is like trying to get rid of your mother-in-law or something. You know, it's like, wait a minute, she's telling you to eat your vegetables. Maybe you should listen to her. You know, she's really telling you something, you know, something important, and, you know, telling you to be healthy and, you know, groom appropriately and eat appropriately and exercise. And you're saying, you know, if I could just get rid of her, then I'll be fine. Well, no, you're just going to be in bed. bad shape, you're going to eat the wrong things, and you're going to get sick when you're younger. So getting rid of the amyloid is going to be great one day when you've gotten rid of all the things that are causing it. Then I do think, absolutely, I actually think that these drugs are going to be helpful in the future. Once you target all the insults and you get people better, now what's happened is the amyloid is, as you know, has a very long half-life. And so it will stay in your brain. It's a little bit like you get the soldiers out to try to fight the bad guys, and then you put them in a fort. So you put the amyloid in these lakes that are actually not very toxic, because you're saying, I might need this again someday. So I want to be able to rapidly depolymerize it and make those oligomers that are fighting the bugs but also downsizing the brain. But as long as you've got the insults, you just keep downsizing, downsizing, downsizing until ultimately you get Alzheimer's and die. So what we want to do is get rid of all these insults, identify them, get rid of them, get all the resilience back, and then we want to add the drug and now slowly get rid of that amyloid over time.
So it's the reverse approach of what most clinical trials are doing right now.
That's exactly right.
So in your book, you talk about there's 33 or 36 different holes that are leaking in your roof, and you call them the biomarkers that we should be looking at. You recently just said that there's 150 now. Or what's the number currently?
Yeah. So the reason that I came up with this original idea of 36, so I sat down one day and said, okay, my gosh, there are all these things that are driving APP in the wrong direction. Like, well, how many of these things? So I looked at, okay, mm-hmm. It's if anything's activating beta secretase, gamma secretase, reducing your alpha secretase, all these sorts of things. So I listed all the things that we knew about, and there were 36. So I said to the patients, look, imagine you've got a roof with 36 holes. The drug is only going to cover one hole. It's really not going to be, and it's an easy way for people to think about, oh, okay, wait a minute, this is how functional medicine works. Now, obviously, it's relatively crude because it doesn't tell you how they all work together, but it's just easy for people to see, yeah, okay, wait a minute, I really have to do more than one thing. Now, what I mentioned about the 150 variables is, we want to collect data. So that doesn't, not all these variables are mechanistically driven. Mm-hmm. So we want to know, for example, if you have things that are related to other neurodegenerative diseases. You know, one of the interesting things that's come out from the neuropathologist recently is that we used to think of these diseases as being very quantal. Okay, you either have Alzheimer's or you have Lewy body or you have frontotemporal. And the neuropathologists have now said, wait a minute, when you look at the brain of an Alzheimer's patient, guess what you see virtually every time? You see beta amyloid, you see phospho-tau. Those were kind of well known. Guess what? Almost all of them have alpha-synuclein as well, which is what we used to think, wait a minute, that's Parkinson's. Mm-hmm. And they almost all have TDP-43, which again, we associate with frontotemporal dementia and ALS. So these are not as perfect as we thought they were. This is, this goes along very much with what Craig and what we're all practicing now to say, yes, there are many things that are driving this. You know, and guess what? Alpha-synuclein is antimicrobial, just like amyloid beta is. This is your body trying to fight these different insults. And so that's why we want to gather data to say, does the historical data suggest that we need to be thinking about the dopaminergic system as well? Do we need to be thinking more about the glutamatergic system? Is it mostly the cholinergic system? Do we need to be thinking more about NGF, BDNF? Because we're now, of course, the arsenal to be able to make a difference in these different neurochemistries is building. So again, this is another thing that's completely backwards. We've all been taught there's nothing you can do about this illness. There's just nothing out there. It's the opposite. The bottom line is there's a huge arsenal, and you have to know how to use it optimally and what's important for each person. So we now have things that can increase your BDNF, things like whole coffee fruit extract, and of course exercise, the classic one. We now have things that can increase your NGF, things like Alcar and Haricia marinacea, you know, the lion's mane mushroom, and things like that. So there are different things that give you the ability to manipulate different parts of the neurochemistry for the benefit of the patient.
That's really interesting. Speaking of some of those alternative therapies or new things that can promote BDNF or NGF, what's your opinion on things like 7-8-DHF or TRKB agonists?
Yeah. So, of course, Dr. Ke-Chang Yi, a fantastic professor at Emory, I've known Ke-Chang for many years. He's doing some absolutely brilliant work on how Alzheimer's develops and specifically around specific cleavages. So a different cleavage event that's different from the alpha and beta and gamma cleavage. And he's shown that this is very important. And interestingly, you know, effects on all again, on this whole system related to dealing with insults and related to trophic factors and things like that. And so they are actually developing various things that will, small molecules that will increase TrkB signaling. They'll increase your BDNF-related signaling. Mm-hmm. And 7-8-dihydroxyflavone was just one of the early things. And so I think that these are going to be valuable.
Okay.
And they're developing ones that are more potent than that.
Absolutely.
So I think that these are going to be helpful. And of course, the whole poppy fruit extract that I mentioned, a lot of people have been using that, increases your BDNF very nicely.
And Dale, you had mentioned sort of, Lewy body and frontotemporal and Alzheimer's sort of all overlapping. Are you seeing that there are any different root causes for Lewy body and frontal temporal that are different than for Alzheimer's?
Yeah, this is a great point. And so again, what we're finding is that each of these things has each of these neural subsystems that's affected has a different Achilles heel. So each thing is, it's kind of like you have a Maserati in the garage, which is running at 200 miles an hour. And that has certain ways, you know, as they always say, certain cars tend to have certain things go wrong with them. But then you've also got, you know, you've got a motorcycle that they can go very fast. That has its own set of problems that typically fail. And that's the way we're seeing these neural subsystems. And so what's happening is, because of evolution, you are driving these systems. Because, yeah, you know, let's face it, evolution is driving you to be able to outcompete other species and other members of your group. That's the way evolution drives you. And so to do that, you are at risk for things failing over time. And so they tend to fail in different ways. So the motor modulation system, which is what's affected in Parkinson's, tends to fail because you're driving it. You need that mitochondrial complex one function. As we talked about with Alzheimer's, it tends to fail because you've got insulin resistance and because you've got toxin exposure and things like that. It is very much like an aging phenomenon. It's almost like, you know, an aging of the brain. You're failing in multiple ways, and you've got to deal with all of them. When you look at ALS and frontotemporal dementia, which are essentially cousins, most people, as Bruce Miller has pointed out years ago, most people with frontotemporal dementia will have some degree of ALS, and most people with ALS will have some degree of frontotemporal dementia, even though it may be modest, at least in some of their subtypes. And so in that case, that seems to be a failure that's common with glutamatergic failure of clearance. So you have this phenomenon of excitotoxicity. You know, if you look at the motor system, what's striking about that, and each of these systems has their own things, what's striking about that is that you have the integration of more signals than you typically have from other systems. So this motor system is having thousands of inputs that are all impinging on it. And, of course, the problem is you've got all this glutamate that's being spritzed onto here. And as long as you can keep up with the clearance of that, you're in good shape. But there are many things that either reduce the clearance of it or increase the amount that's actually coming in. And, of course, one of the things that's been pointed out is LBMAA, which is an excitotoxin, which is unfortunately present in things like cyanobacteria. And this was discovered, of course, by people eating fruit bats, where they have a lot of this stuff. And so you're essentially giving more than the system can handle. And ultimately, the system fails because it's got this excitotoxicity again and again. So again, each of these things has a different way. Now, what we're seeing good results with Lewy body, and Lewy body turns out to be very much related to type 3. Virtually everybody with Lewy body has some toxic exposure. And we've seen metals, and we've seen the biotoxins, and we've seen organic toxins. And I'm sure you've had this same experience, that these people typically have toxin exposures. And again, very much like Parkinson's, there's a wonderful book that came out in Parkinson's a few months ago called A Prescription for Ending Parkinson's. And they pointed out that Parkinson's is more rapidly increasing than any other neurological degenerative disease. It's really a strikingly increasing right now. And they believe it is related to more exposure to toxins. And there are these multiple things like trichloroethylene and perchloroethylene. And of course, although they didn't mention in the book, some practitioners are pointing out that people often have high glyphosate levels when they come in with Parkinson's, especially, you know, young, otherwise healthy people who are showing up with just Parkinson's or just ALS. And it's like, wait a minute, you're in your early 40s and you're doing well. What are you doing getting this disease? And they're turning out to have very high glyphosate levels. Whether that's the key driver, we don't know yet. But as you know, nice work from Stephanie Seneff suggesting that, yes, there's every reason in a molecular sense for glyphosate to drive ALS and other potentially other forms of neurodegeneration. So I tend to think that she's on the right track here. And so I think this is one of the contributors. So yes, I think that we see different patterns. And as I said, Lewy body disease, you know, to a first order approximation, Lewy body means you have Parkinson's drivers and Alzheimer's drivers. And so you need to look at both of those. You need to look very carefully at the toxins. If you've got ALS or frontotemporal dementia, you need to look very carefully at excitotoxic signaling, because that appears to be what's driving this. I have to say, frontotemporal has been the tough one, as you know. People who get frontotemporal dementia, much less common than Alzheimer's, much less common than Parkinson's or Lewy body, but they are people that have been tough to treat and have failed. There is no effective treatment right now, standard treatment for frontotemporal. There are a few examples of people who improve with an integrative and functional medicine sort of approach. And I think that this is where we're really interested in what we're calling the ARC project, which is, you know, the ARC was 2x2x2, to just get small numbers of people who are very early on in these various conditions and look at them very deeply, to look at as many different characteristics to determine what are the drivers of each of these diseases. And of course, genetics represents a part of it, but as you know, in Alzheimer's, 95% of the cases are sporadic. Only 5% are truly familial Alzheimer's disease with APP or PS1 or PS2 mutations. And for most of these diseases, genetics, that's the background, but they're not your fate. They're just giving you your risk.
So what can you do with someone with ALS or someone who has excitotoxicity with glutamate? How do you increase glutamate and improve long-term potentiation, but without getting the excitotoxicity?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very, very good point. And, you know, there's some nice work that came out of Duke looking at people who spontaneously improves, quote, spontaneously. And I think these anecdotes can be very, you know, teachable moments for all of us. With ALS has been so tough, not only because it has not responded well to standard treatment, but also because it marches forward more rapidly than someone with Alzheimer's. So Alzheimer's, you know, it goes year to year, and ALS is going month to month, and people typically are living between, you know, 1 and 3 years is kind of typical. So unfortunately, it is progressing more rapidly, and you really have to jump on it. But they showed a number of things that were associated with either slower decline or with some degree of improvement. Interestingly, it goes back to some of the trophic support, things like IGF-1, which turned out to be important for motor neurons. BDNF turns out to be important for motor neurons. There does seem to be a difference in the metabolic status. So it's not so much about insulin resistance. If anything, the people who had type 2 diabetes progressed more slowly. So again, we have to look at each of these a little bit differently. You've probably seen there's an interesting site called Healing ALS. com. And Coco Newton, for example, and others have worked on this. And they've pointed out that getting the appropriate dietary input turns out to be important for giving these people best outcomes. There is a whole set of things about metals. Interestingly, with Alzheimer's, as you know, copper-zinc ratios tend to be high. This is a characteristic of many of these people with toxicity. In ALS, it's the opposite. The zinc to copper ratio tends to be high. So there are trophic influences. There are metabolic and dietary influences. There are inflammatory influences. There are glutamatergic influences. As you indicated, you've got to have glutamate signaling, but unfortunately, the inability to keep up with it, which again, you know, is why these tremendous athletes like Lou Gehrig that are just driving this, you know, hyper driving the system every day for years, ultimately have trouble keeping up with the, you know, with the glutamatergic signaling. So, you know, the answer is, this is what the ARC project is all about. We want to look and address each of the potential contributors for each of these people. Macular degeneration, another great example, and all of these things that are critical for getting best outcomes.
What have you found with macular degeneration?
So macular degeneration, I actually think, is one of the most intriguing of these neurodegenerative conditions. And, you know, you can argue, well, yeah, it's really about the retinal pigment epithelial cells. It's not a primary neurodegeneration. But it is closely related, and it fits this model. And in fact, it is an important support for the model I've been talking about, for this, you know, this mismatch between the support and the demand. So what happens with macular degeneration, which is about twice as common as Alzheimer's, about 11 million Americans have macular degeneration. This is a major, major global cause of a poor vision. Whether the people become, you know, all the way blind or not, it's a major cause of visual reduction as we age. And what happens there is the as long as there's any light, you are driving this system. You are driving your photoreceptor cells, you know, 24/7. So again, when it's dark, fine, they're off. But otherwise, the whole time, just imagine this, driving these same neurons all day. And so this is, again, like a Maserati going 200 miles an hour. This is a supply and demand issue. And you are right at the limit of supporting these with blood flow, with oxygenation, and with the drivers themselves, blue light. So if you're overdriving them, or if you're undersupplying them, then you're right at that edge and you have a chance. And of course, inflammation plays into this as well. So it's a slightly different formula than Alzheimer's, but it's a similar idea. And so all these different things, you can now see immediately all the things that increase and decrease your likelihood of getting this. So if you live at high altitude where you're getting less oxygenation, guess what? You have an increased risk for macular degeneration. If you live near the equator, you're getting more direct light. Guess what? You have an increased risk. If you smoke, if you have reduced blood flow, any vascular disease, the big one, of course, in the past was people who smoked. They have all these toxins they've added to the system, plus the reduction in blood flow, and they would dramatically increase their risk for having macular degeneration. On the other hand, on the positive side, if you're doing things like hyperbaric or like EWOT, like exercise with oxygen training, you're helping these people. If you are giving them better blood flow, more oxygenation, reduction in inflammation, all of these things are very helpful to these people. Now, some people, it does look like SIRS can be, and we have one example of a patient who's clearly got biotoxins as part of the overall problem and doing well by addressing those in herself, as well as her oxygenation. Insulin resistance also plays a role in this particular illness. So this is something where you've got to get the supply and the demand lined up. One interesting point about this is people with APOE4 are at reduced risk for macular degeneration. People with APOE2, the thing that protects against Alzheimer's, are at increased risk for macular degeneration. And it's a fairly, it's fairly clear effect. And so we need to understand more about why that is.
Well, it's interesting with macular degeneration, that is one of those areas where at least, conventional medicine organizations have embraced that there's nutritional issues that are that exist, and that additional supplementation is effective at improving outcomes. And I might try a little bit of an artificial exercise and question on you around the actual protocol itself, but it might come up in an IRB. You know, if you had to. Obviously, in clinical care, you'd want to address as many of the root causes as possible. But if you had to constrain the protocol to, let's say, your top four or five, interventions, is there any type of prioritization on the protocol? Especially, for example, if people may not have the resources to afford all of the interventions, is there a hierarchy at this point?
Yeah. So, yeah, absolutely. But now the problem is the hierarchy is different
for each
person.
Sure.
That's the tricky part. And one of the things I'm very interested in doing with the computer software is to be able to take each person and say, what is the number one thing for this person, number two, based on their profile? Because it's going to be different from person to person. It's not always obvious. But let me just comment on one thing you said earlier about nutrition for macular degeneration. So as you know, AREDS 2 is the current standard. You have some zinc and some lutein and that sort of thing. With AREDS 2, which is the standard of care for macular degeneration, what they've shown is instead of losing 13 lines of vision, you lose 12 lines of vision. So again, this is something where they're not embracing all the different things that are actually driving this, and therefore the outcomes are very poor. So again, you got to, as you said earlier, you got to exceed that threshold. Now, you mentioned prioritization. Are you talking about for cognitive decline, or are you talking about for visual decline, or for motor decline?
Well, let's keep it at cognitive.
Yeah. Okay. Good. So for cognitive decline, this is where the subtyping is helpful. It's going to be different for each person. The top things are going to be either inflammation and addressing that and identifying pathogens. For many people, pathogens are critical, whether it's herpes simplex, HHV-6A, P. gingivalis, as you know from your oral microbiome, or F. nucleatum or T. denticola or other things, or whether it's more tick-borne illnesses. A lot of people end up having Babesia or Borrelia or Bartonella or things like that that are critical, Ehrlichia, all these tick-borne illnesses. So for them, that's the highest priority. For other people, I'd say the most common is probably going to be insulin resistance and its associated, metabolic syndrome, where metabolic syndrome increases your risk for Alzheimer's by more than double. So several fold increase in your risk for Alzheimer's. And for people who do have metabolic syndrome, improving on that, of course, that is associated with inflammation. It's associated with gut abnormalities. It's associated with signaling changes. So that's going to be the highest priority for those people. And again, you can do a tremendous amount with just diet, exercise, sleep, optimal sleep, stress reduction, and some brain training. All of those are inexpensive. But you can do a lot. And again, the earlier, the better. But unfortunately, there's no one-size-fits-all. That's the thing. This is not a Procrustean the prescription, because it is different for each person. And I see sometimes people will get lost in one detail and not realize that, okay, wait, for you, it's this area, and for that person, it's that area. So it does differ. And in some people, it's going to be getting best vascular performance and energetics. Mm-hmm.
But if I hear you right, it does seem, and it's been a little bit my experience, is that there's thematically lifestyle changes can be applied, pretty consistently across the types, even though, certainly with if you're APOE4/4, there may be some limits on dietary changes, et cetera. But that there is some prioritization that can happen in the protocol.
Absolutely.
But that priority is uniquely determined by where each individual is. It cannot be one size fits all.
Exactly. And this is exactly why we worked on the software. And again, you know, you start out with something like this, and at the beginning, it doesn't add much. You can do a lot on your own. So the next version, what we call Recode, is actually will now make it so that it will do things that you can't do as a practitioner. So in other words, it'll be putting genomics together with imaging changes, with all these different pieces, your exposome, et cetera. Because ultimately, you know, we all should be helped. But this is like having a, you know, an assistant. You know, you should be helped by having all these different pieces of data. You know, it's funny that all this beautiful logic has gone into Google knowing where you shop each day. You know, this all this high-level mathematical logic to sell you stuff. But we haven't been using the same sort of wonderful logic for getting better outcomes in our patients. And it's kind of backwards, you know. Shopping is great, but, you know, patient outcomes are much, much more important.
Yeah, we need to focus our technical resources in the right places now.
Exactly.
In terms of the diet, what kind of diet is it that you advocate?
Yeah, you know, this is a really good point because there's so much now around, you know, what are the critical features of different diets. And, you know, there are people who are just saying, you know, carnivory is the only way to go because it does seem to be helpful to some people who have autoimmune conditions. So great. You know, again, we're agnostic, whatever works. But what's turned out to work the best is what we call KetoFlex 12-3. And people use different variations that, you know, people like Mediterranean diet and things like that. But we just go back to the biochemistry. I have to say, you know, I'm not a nutritionist. So I'm just interested in the biochemistry that drives your synaptic formation and maintenance. Mm-hmm. And what works best for driving that is a combination, which is, number one, getting you into ketosis, somewhere between 1 and 4 millimolar beta hydroxybutyrate, or if you like to look at your acetone, so it's nice not to have to prick your finger, then if you use, for example, Biosense, then you want to get above 7 on the ACEs. You want to be blowing a 10 or a 15 ultimately, which again corresponds to about the same amount of BHB. Mm-hmm. And then, secondly, you want to have some fasting because it has so many helpful things, helpful pieces to that of, you know, 12 to 16 hours and typically at night because, again, it helps increase your BDNF. It helps drive your ketosis. It helps drive your autophagy. So we're, again, just we're focusing on the molecular mechanisms that make the phenomenon of Alzheimer's better.
With fasting, is it just water fasting or is it, would tea and coffee break this type of fast that you're trying to improve autophagy and BDNF?
Yeah, tea and coffee don't break it as long as you don't have calories with them.
Okay.
So, and again, you can also think of a variation on this. It's if you can still keep yourself in ketosis by throwing in some, you know, MCT oil or something. Yeah. Now, that does break your fast. So you're losing part of it, but you're keeping a critical part of it, which is the ketosis part. The general, as you know, the rule of thumb is as long as it's less than 50 calories, you're probably still going to keep yourself in a fasting mode. So that's the critical thing there. Then you want it to be high fiber because high fiber helps your microbiome. It helps your detoxification. You know, where most of us are getting way too little on the overall fiber. So we push people to get at least 30 grams a day. Please get up there. You know, our forebears probably were more like 100 grams a day. But, you know, so many of us are walking around with 5 grams of fiber a day. It's horrible. It's horrible for our glycemic load. It's horrible for our lipids. It's horrible for our gut microbiome, for our detox, all of those.
Tell that to the carnivorous people.
Yeah, exactly. So these things are, you know, these things are critical. So ketotic, so fasting, so getting the fiber. And then, of course, all the phytonutrients that are critical. So this is a plant-rich. And if you want to be a vegetarian, no problem, you can do it. But you also can do it with fish and with some grass-fed beef and with some cheese. So you've got all sorts of workarounds here. There are all sorts of good things you can do, but you just don't want to toxify yourself too much. Get appropriate protein levels. I like to use Chronometer myself. I find it very helpful. And one of the things that popped out for my own chronometer was that I wasn't getting nearly enough choline per day. And so we should all be getting around 550 milligrams of choline or more per day. Most of us are coming in more like 300 milligrams per day. That is not good because acetylcholine is the critical neurotransmitter for Alzheimer's disease. It's the thing that is decreased, and it's the thing that is critical for forming new memories. So the last thing we want to be doing is walking around choline deficient.
All right, that's an interesting point you make about choline and acetylcholine.
Yeah.
I've noticed that when I take anything that is high in choline, whether it's eggs, blueberries, or any cholinergics or anticholinesterase inhibitors, I noticed that it makes my cognition significantly worse. Have you seen that as a result in any of your research?
So you're saying when you increase your choline levels, your cognition gets worse.
That's correct.
And so the one issue that has been pointed out with this is that when you increase choline levels, it has been associated in some people with depression.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's changing your mood, that would make some sense. But if it's just cold, if it's just worse, then have you looked at how much? I mean, maybe you actually are, you know, I have plenty of choline. I don't know. But for most of us, we tend to be too low. And you do need enough acetylcholine to make new memories. So, yeah, that would be my guess, is that it's actually impacting you. Because there is a ratio, as you know, for acetylcholine to your noradrenergics, to dopamine and to...
Absolutely. Yeah, I noticed dopaminergics definitely help with that, the brain fog that I get from acetylcholine. So I just find that interesting that
really
it's
interesting,
highly promoted. Yeah. I know it's really important for cognition. A few others and I have that problem.
Wow. Okay.
With acetylcholine.
So then your cognition does better when you've got enough dopamine?
Better with dopamine or things that reduce acetylcholine. So things just simply like taking Benadryl.
So they're very interesting. Mm-hmm. You know what that, so did you ever have any Asperger's when you were younger?
No, but I believe I'm slightly on the spectrum.
Yeah. So that's been pointed out before. And this goes along really well with when we talked before about this APP relationship. So what's interesting is if you look at young people, obviously you're still a very young guy, but when I go back to when you were growing up, people who have Asperger's who are on that spectrum are actually the opposite of Alzheimer's. They have too much cholinergic. They actually have slightly larger brains than others. They have increase in BDNF. They have an increase in SAPP alpha. That entire system is on the opposite side. And so what's been pointed out is they tend to do better with anticholinergics. And this has been suggested before as a treatment for people who are on that spectrum. On the other hand, the ADHD people are more on the Alzheimer's side. They tend to have reduction. It's interesting, we tried to make a fruit fly model, so-called Alzflimers, years ago in the lab. And so we changed the APP till it was on the Alzheimer's side. And guess what happened? The fruit flies get ADHD. It's really interesting. And they moved, it's very much similar to what we see in humans. It's males more than females. They move way too much. If you give them simple carbs, they get much worse. You give them sort of treatments for ADHD, they get much better. So it's interesting that APP, when it's not degenerative associated with Alzheimer's, when you're looking at it developmentally, that pattern is on the one side of it is Asperger's and on the other side of it is ADHD. So my guess is if you're doing better with these anticholinergics, you probably were a little bit on the Asperger. You know, you got a great brain with lots of very tight synapses, whereas the ADHD side is essentially looseness of the synapses based on your APP signaling.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. I just learned a little bit more about myself.
There you go. So, Dale, I wanted to talk a little bit about implementation of the protocol. I mean, you've had two New York Times bestsellers. You've had, you know, multiple training opportunities for the practitioner community, you know, through MPI, then IFM, and now currently through Apollo. And I know you probably have had now at least hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have trained. So I'd just be interested in your observation about, you know, kind of translation of RECODE into practice. How is How do you think that's going?
Yeah, this is such a good point, because you're right. It's been the practical, and as you, obviously you've dealt with this yourself, and bringing all of your experience with functional medicine to bear on this. And yes, what we found, and we just had a new release of a new training through Apollo, as you mentioned, just recently. And so there are another over 400 people that have now that are going through the training. And of course, it's evolving over time. And you're absolutely right. The surprise here, you know, in the past, the rate limiting step was we didn't know what was causing the problem and we didn't have a medicine for it. Now we know a lot about what's causing it. We have the arsenal is huge, and it's knowing the prioritization, as you said earlier, and it's knowing how to use the various things for specific people. But the problem now is the practical nature of it. So yes, we've had some people who said, you know, I'm now going to be claiming to be doing this and charge people a lot of money, but I'm not really going to do much of it. And I'm just going to see if I can make some money doing this, which is really sad, I think. We've had other people who've embraced it, but said, you know what, it's too hard to do the too many things. You know, this is unfortunately, your brain is complicated, and there are lots of complications that go into this. So we're evolving this as how do we do it best? And we're learning as we go along to, okay, how much can we get done by starting people on the basics, as you said earlier, on, you know, things like the diet and the exercise and sleep and stress? And how much is it going to be that we have to look at specific pathogens? How much are certain modalities? As you know, there's been stuff published recently on plasmapheresis as helpful. And so for some of these people, that's going to be really important and really helpful. But it's expensive. We've had, what about stem cells? For some people, that's really going to be helpful. It's expensive. For other people, EWAT, very helpful, or HBOT, or the hyperbaric, it's expensive. So the question is, when are these just being used as business modalities, and they're not really the critical pieces? And on the other hand, when should we encourage the patients? Look, this is really important. Look, if you can save 90% of what you are going to have to spend for nursing homes, it's probably worth that 10% to keep yourself out of a nursing home. You'll have a better life, and in the long run, you know, you'll save a lot. This has been such a huge problem with, you know, just the tremendous amount of money that's been spent on nursing homes, and just it's, you know, so sad to see these people. And you know, just this last week, one of the people that started several years ago, who turned out to have very significant toxicity, and kind of bounced around and, you know, tried a little of this and a little of that, and unfortunately, ultimately just passed away last Monday. And just hearing about anyone who's passing away from this, it just kills me. It really bothers me, because this is what we've been focusing on for 30 years, to try to make it so that this is a rare disease, so that people respond. But we still do have some people who don't. So you're right. We're having a look at how do you do this practically. And I do think that what has worked best so far is very much of a functional medicine sort of practice, where you get people started. And this is, you know, the sort of thing that we did for the trial. We had three absolutely fantastic functional medicine physicians, Dr. Kat Toops, and you know all these people very well, Kat Toops and Dr. Anne Hathaway and Dr. Deborah Gordon. And they, you know, evaluated the people, looked at the various drivers, and then worked with them in their offices with appropriate nutrition and with appropriate exercise, and they looked at, you know, sleeping, turning out, you know, getting your improvements in sleep, and in turning out to, you know, determine whether you have reduced oxygenation nocturnally, turned out to be huge. All these things are critical. Looking at oral microbiome and gut microbiome, they also used feedback. Stress is so critical in this illness. And people have argued that even you look at the neuroanatomy, the amygdala, and this response to threat, Dr. D.R. Clausen has pointed out repeatedly, part of this disease is that response, not just response to pathogens, but response to threat. And we have a lot of people, as you know, that will go downhill when they are under stress, and will improve when the stress is reduced. And so I think that the functional medicine approach, and continuing to just work with these people over months and tweaking things, has been the most successful way to go. The problem is, of course, people want a quick fix. You know, they want that quick pill. And that simply has not worked in this illness.
And what's the time course if you have a specialized clinician and the patient is committed, can you usually see some type of results or at least a stop and decline within 6 months? Or does it, you know, what's the usual time course of response?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And so typically it's, well, I always tell people, give yourself 3 to 6 months after you've gotten things optimized. So not from day one, but start with, you know, get yourself insulin sensitive and get yourself so that you don't have inflammation. Optimize your sleep. When you've optimized these things, then add 3 to 6 months, and that's when you should be seeing an effect. Now, we do see people earlier. We've had people, you know, respond within a few days because they had, you know, a lot of toxic exposure, and just getting out of that helped them. And we've had people that, you know, after a year or two, they're still tweaking and still improving. One of the things that I'm sure you've seen as well, people will get to a plateau. They'll improve and then they'll be stuck there. And you have to find the rate limiting problem then. You find out, oh, wait a minute, they had a pathogen I wasn't aware of, or, oh, they had a toxicity that I wasn't aware of. And now they'll get in continued improvement. You know, one of the exciting things to me is, as we're able to look at more and more of these variables, we're able to see better and better why each person got this. And you know Sharon Hausman-Cohen, who's got IntelX DNA, which I think has been helpful, looking at who are the people who have nulls in some of their glutathione pathway.
Right.
These are people that are going to be hypersensitive to toxins. So we have to go the extra step for those people. Who are the people that have increased clotting, who therefore we have to go the extra step, maybe, you know, using things like pycnogenol or natokinase, because they're having problems with microclots and microthrombi that we're not aware of. All of these things are contributing. And so, again, I always tell people, you know, give it 3 to 6 months after you've optimized these things. And then if things haven't turned around, we need to dig deeper. And I'm working with, for example, a family right now where the woman clearly responded. She has very significant toxicity. She's clearly improved, but she's on a plateau now. And we need to understand why is it that she really hasn't gone farther? And what, there's something out there that is still contributing to her. Now, the good news, she's stable, but we want to now get over that threshold. As you said earlier, that threshold is a key piece. And we need to understand what is it about that threshold that's being missed?
Sure. So tell us about the new book that came out recently.
Yeah, thanks. So what happened was we, in 2017, published The End of Alzheimer's. Actually, that title, The End of Alzheimer's, that was a title that Random House named. I've been criticized for that title. The title that I wrote that under was called Wit's End. It's the Wit's End is the disease, mm-hmm. and Wit's End is the research.
Yes.
They said nobody is going to buy a book called Wit's End, so forget it. We're not selling this book as Wit's End. So they said we are calling this The End of Alzheimer's. And of course, you know, as a new author, they were right. I was wrong, mm-hmm. But I recognize that it's, you know, it does sound like it's pushing it a little to some people. But again, I had real fights with them about this at the time. When that came out, it was about, hey, we can do this. Here are the things we have to look at. It was about the 36 holes and all that. And a lot of people said, you haven't given us enough details. We want to know day to day. You know, we get someone who's doing this day to day, and we want to know what to buy, where to go, what websites, what workarounds, all those sorts of things. So, and the second one is the program, the End of Alzheimer's program, and it's about the details that weren't in the first book. And I worked with Julie G., who's doing this every day on herself and doing very, very well. She's now been on this for more than 8 years, and she's gone from 35th percentile to 98th percentile on her cognitive testing, just doing beautifully, and also work with my wife, Aida, who's an integrative physician. And so we have the science side, we have the clinical side, we have the day-to-day use side. And that whole idea was to make it practical.
Well, we love the book. We advise all patients on the program to read it ahead of time. And I think the second book has really been very practical, very pragmatic, helping patients implement this. And I hear there's an upcoming book.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. So in August. There's another one coming out, which is called The First Survivors of Alzheimer's. So when we put out the first one, the other thing I wanted to do, I wanted to hear from the patient. I wanted the patients to describe in their own words, this is what it feels like to start having cognitive change. This is what it feels like to go downhill and have your doctor tell you you're going to die of Alzheimer's. And then to be told that, no, there's something to do. And then to get better and go back to work and be back to your family. I mean, this is really an emotional thing. You know, I've had, you know, we had one of the doctors who was crying when the patient came back and was doing so much better. As you know, I mean, to see people turn, which I never saw during my neurology practicing or my neurology residency, or, you know, in the lab, when I was in the lab, I didn't see the mice get better in the lab. You know, this is an emotional issue. And so I have seven people who each tells his or her own story in their own words. You know, this is what it was like. This is what it was like talking to my children and stuff. And they're just such beautiful stories. And originally I had tried to include that in this second book, the program book, but there just wasn't enough room. So this was broken off now as a separate thing, along with, you know, updates, and this is what we're thinking about with these different illnesses. But I have to say, it's wonderful to read these stories from these different people and to hear about, hey, it's not hopeless.
Well, I think hope is really the key piece, because I think so many patients have really get scared of the label and worry that there really is no hope. And I think the new book will probably be really powerful in terms of its impact on people, because it shows that there is hope, and you can hear about it in the program, but hearing individual stories are always kind of the way that touches us.
So. Absolutely.
What's your opinion on ISRIB?
Yeah, so ISRIB is another great example of something where you're trying to use a monotherapy. What ISRIB does is it prevents your brain from doing one of its protective responses. And so ISRIB is a little bit like, you know, firing your CFO. You will let me spend. I know I'm in the red, but you will let me spend. And yeah, you'll be able to spend a little more for a little time. But unfortunately, it's a... You know, again, listen, if it works, I'm agnostic. Anything that works will be great. So far, it's worked, you know, in animals. You're driving the system to shut down its own protective mechanism and make protein when it otherwise is telling itself, I can't afford to make protein right now. And yeah, maybe that'll work. But I'm waiting to see what happens with human clinical trials, because my worry is you're circumventing something which is a natural protection. So I'm concerned that it may be a short-term solution. Now, having said that, all of these things as part of the overall arsenal, when you're doing the right things, may be helpful. So for example, you may need to kickstart things into making the proteins again, into getting rid of that protective mechanism when you've now done everything else right. Hallelujah. It'll be great to have a drug that helps you do that. So again, I think the long term is these drugs that are being discovered are going to be fantastic when used appropriately with appropriate understanding. I do think, you know, the future is all of us as physicians have to be good at strategizing biochemistry. So to think, it's not just anymore about, I give this drug because it worked in a double-blind trial. I'm giving this drug knowing what all the changes in the system that it's doing. So I am saying this system is out of whack because of a set of things, and I am impacting that set of things, and part of that is going to be this drug.
That's awesome. What should people be doing for prevention? I know you mentioned in your book Precode, and people should be getting a cognoscopy at the age of 50. Right.
Yeah, 44. We even said 45. Because we see people, as you know, we're seeing people late 40s, early 50s who clearly have cognitive changes. So we recommend anyone who's 45 or over, get checked, get a cognoscopy. It's simple. It's, you know, three things. It's a set of blood tests. It is online cognitive assessment, very simple. And then the third piece, which is an MRI with volumetrics. If you're asymptomatic, don't worry about the MRI. Just get the first two. If you're symptomatic, you want to include an MRI. And then we developed this Precode simply as a way to say, okay, here's a set of things that you need to look at. Here are the blood tests and the urine tests that are critical for knowing what your risk. So again, just like knowing your cholesterol, people have done for years, or knowing your lipid profile, you want to know that whether you're at risk for cognitive decline, because it's always easier to prevent it than it is to reverse it.
Absolutely. I totally agree to that.
If people want to know more and learn more, how can they find out more about you?
Yeah, thanks so much, Craig and Jacob. Appreciate it, and the discussion. Lots to do. So yeah, you mentioned the books. You can go on drbredesen.com. If you're interested in training or Recode or Precode, you can go on apollohealth.com. So any of those things to look at. And you know, there's a Facebook, Dr. Dale Bredesen, as well, and Twitter. So you can follow those as well. So any of those, there's lots of ways to find out. And I do think, again, we want to get the whole world to know that dementia should be rare, and let's get prevention or the earliest possible reversal and really see a decrease in the global burden of dementia.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks, Craig. Thanks, Jacob. Great to talk to you guys. Happy New Year. Yeah. Stay safe.
Thanks, Dan.
And look forward to talking to you next time.
Okay. Appreciate it.
What a time to be alive. With this type of technology, I'm really excited about our future. So, thanks guys for listening, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Reslayer Way. If you want to find out more information about the Bredesen Protocol or how to prevent cognitive decline, I encourage you to head over to reslayerhealth.com or mybiohack.com, as we've written up a few different articles describing Dr. Bredesen's research. We also encourage all of our patients to read Dr. Bredesen's The End of Alzheimer's. Thanks, guys. And I'll catch you in the next episode.